Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to I'm a Writer But. My guest today is Daniel Swearenbecker. Daniel Swearenbecker is an author, a television writer, and a playwright living in Los Angeles. He graduated from Wesleyan University and received an MFA from New York University. His play Stress Positions premiered in New York City at the Soho Playhouse, and he is the author of the novels The Ones and The Equals. His new novel is Kill Show. When 16-year-old Sarah Parcell goes missing, it's an utter tragedy and an entertaining national obsession in this thoughtful and addictively readable novel that offers a fresh and provocative take on whodunits and true crime. Welcome, Daniel.
Hello, Lindsay. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. I can't think of a book that's more written just for me than Kill Show.
Yes. So,
I couldn't wait to read it, and I'm so happy to talk to you about it.
And just on that note, it's exciting when I read a book like yours and it's like, oh, this is in the same ballpark, but it's not the same at all. That's like the perfect Venn diagram of not making me upset, but making me kind of feel validated that other people are having similar creative impulses.
Yes, there's like something in the air right now.
Yes.
Because Laura Sims wrote How Can I Help You, which is also based on a real murder.
Sure.
A real, you know, case that she also heard on a podcast. And I don't know, I'm loving it. Can you read a little bit to us from Kill Show?
Yes, I will read briefly. And just so the listeners understand, I wrote this book as a fictional oral history, which means we have 26 different characters looking back at this crime event from 10 years in the past. And the first character I'm going to read is named Molly Lowe. She's actually a professor of sociology who has become obsessed with the events in question. And this is her kind of summary. So here she goes. True crime obsession is nothing new and relatively easy to explain from a sociological perspective. We know violence is titillating. Adding the veneer of truth makes it even more so. Every true crime story carries an implication that makes it scarier than fiction. Look, this could have happened to you, but it didn't. Because you're either luckier or smarter or more deserving. Congratulations. But there's another dopamine hit embedded in the best true crime. What people crave even more than a thrill is being involved, feeling a sense of belonging and purpose. Whether it's a family, fraternity, political party, any number of things, we all register significant boosts in happiness when we are part of a group. Even better, a group with a clear objective that reinforces this heady bond. And if the objective is perceived as noble, watch out. Individuals will give away their whole lives to pursue that goal. Now, what's more noble than saving the life of an innocent girl? It is literally the archetypal epic story. A girl out there somewhere who needs our help, a damsel in distress. That's what Casey Hawthorne tapped into with Searching for Sarah. This was her genius. She got her viewers to believe they were joining the rescue party. That's why millions of them became obsessed with it. And now just switching gears to Marcus Maxwell, who is the senior TV executive who greenlight the reality show about this girl. Here's his take. After we did Searching for Sarah, I had this flashback to when my daughter was 5 or 6 years old. She would come downstairs when my wife and I were watching TV, and sometimes we'd quickly turn it off or change the channel. She'd ask why, and we'd say it wasn't appropriate for kids to watch. But my daughter came up with her own name for it, you know, for shows that were too violent for her. She'd ask, "Is it a kill show?" That's what she'd call it. "When will I be old enough to watch a kill show?" We think we shield our kids from this stuff, but they know what's out there. I thought about that after the finale of Searching for Sarah. We never set out to make a kill show, but we were being naive. End scene.
So good.
Thank you.
You explore so many different aspects of true crime, and it's a, place in culture right now. And I was bowled over with I didn't, so you said there's 26 different voices. I didn't even realize. I knew there was a lot. I didn't realize it was that many characters that you're pulling from and using. Why did you decide to do an oral history for this novel?
You know, there's so many ways to answer it. I'll take you back to square one. I am just a very big fan of like traditional oral histories, and some of them are about like really stodgy topics like the Great Depression or, you know, World War II. And I find them so accessible to read, kind of as like I used to read, you know, the great epic novels, and I now find my attention span a little diminished. So the way these books kind of flow, and you can read 5 pages at a time and pick them back up. And then in a little more serious way, you get such an intimacy with the characters to hear them in their own voice, to hear their perspectives. I always found that interesting. I started to find myself reading a little bit more of the fun oral histories, you know, like The Making of Dazed and Confused or The History of SNL. And all of that crested when I picked up Daisy Jones and the Six. I assume you read that at one point.
I know I haven't. Everyone recommends it to me, and I have still not read it.
All right, it's so much fun. It's a fake oral history about a fake rock band.
Okay.
And it was such a thrill ride to read. And I was racing through it. And like everyone else, I was like, is this rock band real? Are these songs real? Like Googling the lyrics and stuff. And I put the book down when I finally closed. It's a great book. And I really stared at the wall and said, this is a genius format. How can I replicate this in a different way? I'm not going to do another fake rock band. And I just thought to myself, oh my God, the true crime genre is the perfect way to meld these two things together, because this is all about that kind of Rashomon syndrome of who remembers things differently and how memory changes over time and how your motivations and incentives are different, you know, depending on what you're trying to do. And I thought to myself, if I could just get a bunch of characters who have a different perspective on this sensational crime, that would be a perfect way to adapt this format.
I, as always, I'm always thinking of like how I would do it or like what I would do if I had that idea. And I know that I'd be like, okay, if I had the idea of doing an oral history of something, it would be four characters tops. And so I just know that about myself. And so the fact that you are so ambitious with the number of characters, because it offers us, not only is it doing the work of like establishing the plot and establishing all the twists and turns that it takes and giving us only a little bit of information because each character has their own, bit of information and they're revealing it. It's so brilliant the way that the information is revealed because we're hearing them tell the story and they're going to tell it in order, right? And so like we're going to get that as we go. And then you have that other technique of like, I'm going to check in with this character and fact check what this character just said. And we get a little bit more information there, and it reveals it's like you, the way that you're laying that out plot wise. I want to talk all about that. But in addition to
And wait,
that,
let me just jump in there because you made me think of so many things. So first of all, your instincts are totally correct, where when I had the idea, I was like, oh yeah, like five characters, you know, like the cop, the parent, the producer, whatever. And then 2 hours after that, I'm like, wait, no, let's add five more. And then like 2 days after that, I was like, okay, wait, five more. And the benefit of that, or the ease of it, is that You can just add these little side characters relatively easily without having to come up with like some gigantic plot line. So many of the 26 characters are in the book for, 3% of it.
Right.
So it wasn't so much of a burden. And then the other thing that you kind of hit on was, thank God I did not think through this book in the perspectives of those characters before I knew the general arc. So I said to myself, oh, great, let me do this oral history format, but I'll put that aside for a minute and just think, what is the arc of this narrative? A to Z, without worrying about inserting anyone's specific voice yet. Once I had that arc, I was like, okay, now here are the sections I want to live with this character, live with that character, and doing it in that order made it manageable.
Absolutely. I think that's such a good point. And another way that I would have failed because I would have immediately just started writing. But what you're also doing is you're offering this like commentary of the very thing that a reader is doing reading this book, right? It's like you recognize, and the way that the book ends also is a sort of like a tip of the cap to what I'm doing as I'm reading this, tearing through this book about this novel that is, mired in true crime. I don't want to say tropes because that sounds insulting, but like the facets of
No,
true
first of all,
crime.
not insulting at all, because that's very intentional. Like from
Right.
the outset, it's a missing teenaged white, pretty white girl
Yes,
in the
yes.
most typical town in the country with the most typical family. And I would have loved if everyone read the first 15 pages and go, this is so derivative of everything else in the world, and then hopefully get their expectations subverted. But tropes is totally appropriate. Sorry, I interrupted the what else you were saying.
No, and I think that's a good point about like when you're reading the first 15 pages, you're kind of like, I'm in my comfort zone here, which is, I know that that's problematic to think about true crime or something like that in terms of comfort, but it is. It really is like there's recognizable aspects of it. I feel like, I'm in good hands here, and then it pivots. And I actually think that there's a pivot even before that because you give us a cast of characters so that we can keep track of of everyone. And like,
And yeah, that was actually a very big point of contention between me and my editor and publisher about including that list at the front of the book. And I was like, I know personally, if I was reading this book, I would go back to that every 20 pages and be really relieved to have that kind of guiding, map. And then I saw that as an opportunity to put a few Easter eggs in that list
yes.
of characters. And to be honest, I think 70% of readers have never seen that page. And when I tell them about it, their mind is blown. But for the 30% that did scan that page closely, I do think there are some nice payoffs there.
Oh, for sure, because you find out, okay, we're going to hear from the wife of this one character who's now dead. So
Right.
you're like, okay, huh, well, maybe time has passed and they got old and they died or whatever. And then you're like, oh, wait, the father's in jail.
Yeah,
Well,
that's the
okay.
big one.
Right. Like, okay, maybe like a horrible thing happened to his family. Maybe he life took some turns and he's in jail for some other reason, or maybe he attacked the person who did this to his daughter. Like your mind starts like trying to come up with reasons why he'd be in jail. And one of the reasons is, well, holy shit, did he kill his daughter?
Right.
Like what happened there? And so like already at the outset, if you are paying attention, and I know a lot of people like to flip past epigraphs, table of contents, like cast of characters, maps, prologues. I know they like to get rid of that and just get into the meat of it. But if you did read it, there's so many bits where you're like, now wait a minute, I have a question about that. Like what? I want to
And
know.
what you're really getting to is, I had so much fun writing this book because I knew I was in a game with the reader. And I know you can relate to this, but dispensing information at the exact amount that I wanted to kind of lead them down a pathway that was either useful or would be, a red herring. And I just felt like so in control of that based on like the format and the way the story worked that I was like smiling to myself, like typing a sentence in the early chapters that I knew would indicate one thing. And of course, it's going to indicate the other. And I really hadn't worked in kind of like the mystery genre, which I'm not sure this is like technically in,
Right.
but we are unraveling a mystery. And I was just so tickled personally getting to like dole out that information as I saw fit. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I think like when I was a kid, I used to draw mazes. And I would always draw like one or two correct paths, and then I would like completely obscure it with all these other, obviously. And it seems like that's kind of what you did. Like you sat and thought through what the story was. You had the correct, like the path. And then what you did was you like laid all these other like obscuring red herrings or MacGuffins or just pivots in to make people go, wait, what? I thought I had this, right?
That's exactly what I did. And to be honest, I didn't do it very much on my first draft, and some readers and then eventually my editor were like, we need more of those. And I felt a little uncomfortable. I was like, I'm not trying to torture the reader so they hate me, but it turns out that like having that or attitude of torturing the reader might actually lead to some good content.
Okay, that's interesting. I like what did you view was like a torturous thing that you had to do?
That thing with the Grassley family, where
Okay, the father.
the neighbors and the father kind of has his life ruined, and we devote a fair amount of time to that. And I don't know, I felt like almost uncomfortable like ruining this fictional family's life. It ended up serving like several purposes, but it that was just like a second red herring suspect. Spoiler alert, a little late in the podcast, but that's fine. But just all these red herring suspects, I was like, should I have five of them? I originally had, one or two. And at a certain point, you imagine the reader will start rolling their eyes. So the sweet spot might be three or four. I'm trying to think, was there anything else I had to tap? This is a slightly different subject matter, but by the end of my first draft, I had one really big twist in this novel that I was like so proud of and excited. And my editor read it and she was like, we need a second really big twist. And that was a very jarring thing to hear because really big twists don't just grow on trees and they're relatively difficult to insert into a finished draft. So I had to really go to the drawing board and be like, how can I have another major surprise that's not just about like, evidence or the mystery, but is much more emotional and character centered. And that is what I did with the main character, Casey, and her behavior at the end of the book, which I won't spoil, was tacked on after my first draft, and it ended up working. But the amount of sweat that I had to shed to make that work was very difficult, and I was irritated at first and learned the lesson of like, oh my God, my editor is right. Doing hard work on the second draft is useful. So now I'm so grateful about it, but that week where I was angry about it was not fun.
I say like there was so many moments where I thought, I've figured this out. And I've got, two-thirds of the book left to go. I'm so
Right.
smart. And then a character would say exactly the thing that I was thinking and blow it up. And I'd be like, oh my God, and that to me is so worth it as a reader. Like, I love when that happens, when you think to yourself, like, well, great, okay. Now I can see how this is going to fall into place. I know what this character is going to do. I know what this character is going to do because they're going to try to obscure or hide this thing, or have it play out this way. And then someone just comes along and says it, right? And we're trying to talk about it in a way that doesn't spoil things. I think we will have to just spoil
Oh, we
things.
can,
Like,
yeah, we can.
people
I'm
are just
happy
going to
to
have to get
spoil
over
it. Yeah.
it. But those moments at the end with Casey that you're talking about, like, first of all, the rapper.
Right.
And then, and then whether or not, I'm forgetting the cop's name.
It's funny. I like you saying the rapper, which could either be like a candy bar rapper or a
Yes.
musician. So it's we mean candy bar rapper. There is no rap musician in this.
Yeah,
It's a
we could have left it as is and people can just read and find out,
Yeah,
okay? It
it's
could be a
like
rapper or it
she
could be a
becomes a
rapper.
freestyle, battle rapper.
Yes, because that to me was like we knew what happened, we knew who did it. But then there were still surprises to be had, and
Yeah,
like
and look, the book ends for the most part, three quarters of the way through, and you think what could be on the next page, and then one of the characters says, that's not what happened at all. And I
yes.
was like, okay, this feels fun, and it speaks to the usefulness of the Rashomon nature and the oral history. But look, that was the stuff I had to add. And it's funny, the rapper thing was almost the easiest part because once I figured out that there needed to be this kind of totem that indicated Casey's presence, I needed to go back and put that in the rest of the book. And I was like, oh my God, this is going to be so difficult. And then like 20 minutes later, I just like put that into two different scenes. I was like, oh, that wasn't hard at all. Thank God I was like able to like set this up so that it didn't feel, you know, disingenuous.
Yeah, there's something about the color that you chose that just sticks with you. I don't know.
You know, that you are such a writer for noticing that, because this is based on somewhat of a true event of someone I knew who was obsessed with this snack bar in LA, and the name of the snack bar is correct and the name of the store is correct, but the packaging of that particular snack bar is totally nondescript and unmemorable.
Okay.
And I just said to myself, I'm going to take a liberty and describe this thing as neon pink, because it's going to be useful to be neon pink. And the fact that you picked up on that, yes, I'm grateful about that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, there's not a lot of bright colors, I guess, in the novel, you know,
yes.
Even though it centers around like a teenage girl and you know, she has a
oh, it's supposed to be
and
dark in that
dark,
part of
yeah.
spring where the leaves haven't come in yet and it's wet and brown. So yeah, that pink almost stands out in a more emotional way than I could have ever intended.
And it's so great too in characterization for Casey, because it's like, of course she's obsessed with this one. Like, I think is it strawberry geranium?
It is rose geranium.
Rose geranium.
What? I don't even have that on the tip of my tongue. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, it's like so bizarre, but it's so LA. And
yeah.
So it's like, okay, of course that's all she's eating. You know,
yes.
She's just eating these. She's pounding like three of those at 9 o'clock at night. And that's all she eats all day.
Right.
And it's in this luridly wrapped, you know, candy bar. I just thought that was so, it just sticks with you. And of course, like if you see that in a cabin in the middle of nowhere, it's going to be like, wait, what's that doing there?
You know, it really represents the dichotomy, which is like a much bigger theme of like LA, Hollywood, Tinseltown,
mm-hmm.
and the real America. And Casey is coming in from Hollywood to what she thinks is the real America. And it is the real America. I don't know how anyone wants to define that. But there is this clash of cultures and this clash of morals. And I was really excited to explore that as someone who lives in Hollywood and rolls my eyes at a lot of what goes on out here, but also like participates in it,
mm-hmm.
which is my own, you know, moral crisis. But I had never thought of that being embodied so well in the visual of the pink bar, the way you're describing it. But I now see that it kind of organically happened that way. And that's pretty cool.
And it was probably organically made.
Yes, for sure. Yeah,
LA.
Biodynamic, whatever else they want to slap exactly. onto it.
Well, this novel feels like a perfect amalgamation of your background. Because of the oral history, you're a playwright, right? Like you're always thinking about dialogue. You're always thinking about that kind of stuff. You know, like you've written two novels before, you know, you live in LA. Like, does it feel like, oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, you're
also
scratching the surface in a way that you wouldn't know the deeper stuff, but this actually really stems from my first jobs out of college was working on documentaries, and I was working at HBO, and I was, you know, a PA, which is having barely any responsibility, but we would travel around to shoot interviews with the documentary subjects we were doing. And I was so alarmed or curious about how we would edit these interviews. And we were never like ruining anyone's life, but it was evident to me that documentaries are not exactly like truth, and they're not exactly journalism. They also fit into entertainment and more broadly show business and even more broadly capitalism. And when those incentives are tacked onto the concept of truth, you really muddy the waters. And I was like, wow, I feel a little uncomfortable. You know, like we edited this sentence to have a slightly different context than the person who said it. What does that mean about us? Are we like manipulating this situation? Are we going to change this person's life? So none of that was that interesting in terms of life or death in the documentaries I was working on in my 20s. But once I was out in Hollywood for a bit longer and kind of became a big true crime fan myself, you know, watching the shows, listening to the podcast, I was thinking to myself, I know these are not 100% true. And I know that the people making them know that. I'm really curious about exploring what the implications are for the people kind of selling their soul a little bit. And I don't mean that they're awful people or they should go to prison, but let's say selling their soul 1% to translate these stories and often exploit the people behind these stories. And I was like, are we all doing this in Hollywood? Like, even if we're not working in crime, I was like, you know what? I'm debating this with my friends. It's fun conversation. I don't have a good answer. And the minute you say to yourself, this is interesting, but I don't have a good answer, is the minute I was like, this is worthy of writing about. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily to get an answer, because I don't think I have a perfect answer about how to manage all of this. But I do think I prompted a lot of interesting exploration. So that's my long-winded way of saying that I was just really interested in these themes and realized it was worthy of a story that would be compelling to read.
It's so interesting. I just watched some documentary, quote unquote documentary, on Netflix. It was a true crime documentary. I think it's called Lover, Stalker, Killer.
And okay. I don't think I saw that, but just quick check-in. It wasn't the one where the woman got kidnapped and no one believed her boyfriend. Did you see that?
No. Okay. I listened to the Criminal podcast episodes about that story. I have not watched the Netflix documentary on it.
Because that was the one that's so close to Kill Show of like, there is a missing person and it's not what you think. And how many different people are going to screw this up between the journalists, the police, the family. So anyway, that was the one I just enjoyed and then felt guilty about enjoying. But tell me about the one you saw.
That one's called American Nightmare. And
exactly,
it is an insane story. It is completely wild what happened to those people. So if I'm sure lots of people have watched it, but if you haven't or listened to the Criminal episodes about it, you should, because it's bonkers. No, the one that I'm thinking of is about this dude who got a divorce but followed his family to, I think it's South Dakota, and starts going out on the dating apps, and he meets a woman and they're dating and they're both casual about it. They don't want to stay together.
Let me just interrupt you. I am so nervous for whatever you're about to say, because I know it's gonna just make me feel awful and make me feel awful about people in general, but go on.
Well, this is why we listen, right? Because we're like,
yeah,
what?
You have me on the edge of,
tell me
of
what?
My seat.
So he's dating this lady. I think her name's Liz. But he's like, you know, I'm freshly divorced. I've got kids. I'm not looking for anything serious. I just want to have fun. And she's like, me too. Great. Perfect. And in the meantime, he meets someone else on the apps and they start dating and they're a little bit more hot and heavy. Well, then like 2 weeks into their relationship, she texts him, let's move in together. And he's like, didn't we just talk about this? I thought we were just having fun. Then she disappears and she starts threatening his family. She starts going crazy and like, burning that first woman's house down, like taking pictures of his ex-wife and his kids at their house and sending them to him and threatening and like,
oh my
saying
God,
all this horrible stuff. And no one knows where she is. The cops are involved. No one can figure out where she is. Well, anyway, it turns out the first lady was pretending to be the second lady because she was mad that he had started dating the second lady and she had killed the second lady. And anyway,
so well, okay, well, that is wild and cool
wild
and interesting. But wait, had he not met them?
Met who?
The first and the second lady.
No, he had. He'd been dating them. Yeah, yeah.
But wait, what do you mean pretending to be the second lady? Like physically?
So no one could ever find her. No one ever saw her. She was just like sending these wild text messages and emailing and sending all these horrible threats, saying this horrible stuff, doing terrible things. You know, the house fire she set killed the woman's pets. Well, it turned out that woman started her own house fire and killed her own pets in order to impersonate the woman that she'd killed. And so it's fascascinating. It's well worth watching.
Doesn't this just make you feel very nervous about ever writing another novel, because truth is stranger than fiction? And like, how could you have conceived anything that, or maybe you've already done it once or twice, but how could you do it again, conceive anything that rich and complicated and absurd?
Well, I always come to that where I'm like, oh my God, I have to write about this. And then I'm like, can I do that again? Because I just did that, you know, like I need to do something else. But in that documentary, and like, they have to show you things quickly, right? Like, they have to get you established on who this dude is, where he's living, his family situation, et cetera. And they do it with like these very tropey, manipulative, you know, scenes of him, you know, like standing in his auto mechanic business or whatever. And when there's voiceover, you can very clearly hear that they took a word out of his sentence and put a different word in.
Oh God.
And sometimes that's because, oh, we need him to say this person's name So we're just going to have like this other time that he said her name, we're going to just like clip that in here. But other times it's like, no, wait, what did he actually say? You know? And so like that's they're very clearly like maybe for clarity's sake, or maybe to make it more interesting to a viewer, they're making these choices, they're making these edits. And it's like these things that you're deciding to show and how you're deciding to show them, it makes you think like, oh, this is just a good old boy in South Dakota, and he was just, you know, hardworking man and father, you know, just trying to honestly have some fun and go out dating and stuff. But it's like, I don't know that. All I know is what they've shown me, you know,
Right.
and like,
It's so complicated for the filmmakers or the writers. And the moment that like poured jet fuel on my interest in this was the ending of the documentary series, The Jinx. Did you watch that?
okay, I was going to ask you if that was one of the things you worked on,
Yeah,
because
I did
yeah, when
not
he's
work on
like,
that. I just enjoyed that as a fan. And then in the finale, and just for the listeners, the Robert Durst confesses on a hot mic that he killed everyone.
as he's
And
burping,
then
right?
yes, or he's peeing. I don't know what else he's doing. And he confesses these murders, and then the documentarian holds this information for 6 months as he's editing. And I was like, oh my God, what a dilemma of you have this bombshell finale, but you also have this imperative to go to the cops and tell them that a murderer has confessed. So I had been thinking about that for years, and I just find it so interesting to put the characters in the bind of what's more important, telling the truth or telling the best story? And for some people in the world, it's obvious telling the truth is more important. But if you've chosen the industry I have and you have and Casey has, which is being a storyteller and identifying as such, there's part of you that says the world needs me to tell the story in the best way, and I should be able to manipulate things. And for Casey, the moment for her, which I think is so interesting, is early in the book, she moves a teddy bear from one place to a different place in the girl's bedroom. And I don't think anyone would argue that that changed the course of events. How could a teddy bear being moved from a closet to a bed, how could that change anyone's life? But for her, that is crossing the Rubicon of I am willing to manipulate the truth to tell the story better. And of course, she does that in a much more meaningful way with much more,
Dire
tragic impacts
consequences.
later in the story. So I think we've all probably been willing to move that teddy bear. I hope that we never get to the point where we do the second thing.
I know it's tough. I mean, with the Robert Durst case, I'm sure they told themselves like, well, he wasn't saying it to anyone, and he was just muttering under his
Is a doddering
breath.
old man.
He's an old man. What are the cops going to do? You know, like what's he going to do in between now and when the show comes out? But also, they should have gone and told the cops, right?
Yeah, if you're like his neighbor or his ex-girlfriend, you'd probably
Right.
appreciate like the cops being aware of that confession.
Exactly. What do you think it is that writer, I because we're not the only ones, right? Why do writers love true crime so much?
It's a good question. I mean, look, the cynic in me is like the stakes are extremely high. It's often life or death. I'll then just bring in a personal explanation for it, where I found that in writing this book, and I didn't fully understand it as I started, that this was going to lead me to be able to discuss things I'm very interested in that really don't have anything to do with true crime. And for lack of a better term, just like social and cultural and political issues that exist in our society. And I was able to create these two characters of like the sociology professor and the TV critic, who were able to weigh in with what I call derisively my personal op-eds. And my editor had to cut those down a little because those were the things I enjoyed writing about most in the book. But to get back to your question of why is true crime interesting to explore, it's not just the classic mystery. Okay, there's a dead body, whodunit? Clearly, everyone enjoys that. It's that these tragedies are often revelatory about much more complicated things going on in the world, and our obsession with solving them allows us to see those issues in a different light that's not so kind of dry and academic. So I guess the short answer is they're both exhilarating and intellectually stimulating, if I had to put it in a six-word answer.
I'm glad that you mentioned your personal op-eds, because there's like so many good ones in here, and I was like really vibing on those. And I'm trying to find the one where one of the specialists is trying to explain Dave's white man rage.
Oh, sure. Yeah, like the fragility of white men or whatever I called it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
I don't
just
know what page it's on if you want to find it, but
I thought I had marked it, but I can't find it. But they're talking, basically making the point that like change happened so quickly for white men because they had always been so privileged, and the necessary change came around and it was good and necessary, but at the same time it happened so fast that they weren't able to adapt as quickly, and they also don't have the tools to deal with that kind of change because they've been so privileged. I thought that was like a really necessary conversation that we should be having. I think it's hard to have that conversation without sounding like too precious or even on all sides, right?
Yeah,
And
that was a really tricky one for me to write about, should privileged white men be offered any sympathy or benefit of the doubt as the world changes around them and they lash out in really unconstructive ways, unproductive ways, often violent ways. And it's tricky for two reasons. I'm a privileged white man and the world's changed around me and I'm dealing with it, and I don't want to be in the bad column of dealing with it poorly.
Right.
I
Yes.
support the changes that are happening. And then I've also thought about what's happened in this country over the past, was it 6, 7 years, and looking for explanations that explain our politics and our current moment. And I do see a giant cohort of people that just seem to have grievance about the world changing. And I'm like, oh, intellectually, I get being upset. I get being frustrated at those changes. What grace do these people deserve? And I think my short answer is they deserve a tiny bit of grace. They don't deserve grace to like persecute others or kill their daughters or whatever it is. So I wanted to explore that again. I don't think I've come to like the perfect answer. I think the judgment that I lay on the book is that we shouldn't forgive Dave the father, even though the cards were stacked against him a little bit in a new way for him that doesn't justify his behavior. So I just wanted to give a hat tip to, okay, yes, let's acknowledge that this man and others like him are going through a moment, but that doesn't excuse the results of that moment.
I really love that because, again, it's just like it's a hard conversation to have, but it's a good conversation to have. Which reminds me of another true crime podcast that I just listened to. I think it's like the third or fourth season of Chameleon, and it's about the Michigan dudes who were going to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer.
Okay, so
And
I haven't heard the podcast, but I'm familiar with their little plot, which when I think about it, like I laugh because it seems so absurd and comic.
it
But
is.
it's also like they were going to assassinate a politician and they were instigated by other politicians to do it, which is like
Yes.
extraordinarily serious and depressing. So anyway, did you learn anything new about it?
It is. I learned so much about that. I thought I knew the story. I didn't know the story. Apparently, like there were more FBI informants in that little group than there were members, and the
Oh,
FBI
wow. That's
informants,
complicated. Not in the way that I was
yes,
hoping. Makes me
right.
nervous.
It's yes, like they were egging them on and providing the resources, and there was really only one guy who even wanted to do anything. The rest of the guys just wanted to smoke weed like and talk trash. And a bunch of the guys, they have audio of a bunch of the guys saying, "Well, I'm not doing anything like that. I'm never going to do anything offensive. I'm only here for defense. Like if they come to us." And so it's much more complicated than the story that we're told, which is that they were going to, grab her, hold her, hurt her, it's well worth listening to. I think it's called the Michigan Plot, but it's like it's part of the Chameleon
That's
series.
really interesting, and I feel a little unsettled that I didn't know those elements, but it's a reminder that like it's so easy to tell us the same story from a different perspective and get to a wildly different place.
Yes,
And that's
exactly.
an amazing benefit for us as writers, and it's not as amazing for us as citizens.
Exactly. And I the reason it reminded me of that is because it was a bunch of guys who felt lonely and really like underused and didn't really know where to turn. And if we had people working in the government who were going to infiltrate those groups and direct them toward ways they could be useful in society, that would be so much better than, hey, I think I can egg these guys on to like standing on a cliff like across the lake from Gretchen Whitmer's house, and I'll take a picture and that'll be them. doing recon, you know? And so
Yeah,
it's like,
what you're describing is like the challenge of living in the modern world and living in America, which is one of the broadest topics you can imagine, but we are able to talk about it via true crime, and that's very exciting to me.
that's such a good point. This is the way that we can frame it, right? Is to sort of under, and I think that's why I love the criminal podcast so much, because it's like, it really, it's not lurid true crime, you know, like salacious murder. It's about like, here's a human being that made this choice one time,
Right.
you know?
And they're not just a human being, there's like all these other forces that push this human being to the place where they're making these decisions.
Yes, exactly. Speaking of those kinds of decisions, did you have Balloon Boy in your head when you were thinking about this kind of hoax?
That's a funny question. The short answer is I don't think so, but I must have in the sense that like that is the seminal fake child missing thing from, the past 10 or 15 years. So maybe it was at the very start of it. And I was like very into that story when it happened. So I'm
Yes.
aware of it. I think it may have like gone in one ear and out the other pretty quickly, but the kid's name was Falcon, right?
Oh, I don't even know his name. I just remember feeling like intense, like pity for the father that he would stoop to this, 'cause like it was
Yes.
his plan, right? Like it was his plan, you know, to have this hoax so that he could, I don't know.
Well, you're speaking of something which I find so sad, which is like these parents, both in the book and then the Balloon Boy father, exploiting or co-opting their children to do this desperate maneuver, and the children, out of love, agreeing to participate. That is like so emotionally heavy to me. And to get to that place in this book was actually really difficult because we had to have Sarah, the daughter, go along with her father's plot. And the first version of the book did not have that motivation working. And it turns out I had to add that scene in the garage where she started to fear for her father's life. And that was enough for me to say, okay, I believe she can toss aside her morals, her future, and try to save her father. And I don't know, I felt really tense writing that father-daughter stuff because to me that felt like a real relationship that was so sweet but so messed up that the father had put her in that position.
Yeah, and he's playing on, whether consciously or not, the fact that she's a child and her understanding of these things is going to be limited, right? Like
Right.
she's going to go along. He's the adult, so she's going to believe him when he's like, this will go off without a hitch. It'll be great and we'll be fine, you know? And you, as a child, you have these sort of like supernatural beliefs and love in your parents, or you can, right? And so that can fuel you kind of thinking like, I can do this, you know, and he's treating me like I can do this, and that feels good, and it's going to solve a lot of problems. And it is, it's really heartbreaking. There is real heartbreak at the center of this novel, which is also about all these other things that we've been talking about.
For sure. Yeah, I don't have anything to add.
Well, you out of nowhere, it feels like, got this amazing New York Times review, what, like a month after the book came, what was it, a month or two after the book came out?
Yeah, and I'm like relatively, I did have a couple of YA novels come out, so I'm not new to writing and having books come out, but I was new to like, oh, this is a book for adults. I'm hoping to get reviews in real places. And I'm dealing with a publisher, and there's a publicist at the publisher, and she's working her rear end off trying to make things happen. It didn't seem like anything epic was going to happen. And then out of the blue, I think we got an email a couple of days before. They're like, you're going to be included in this week's book review. And I'll confess, I am one of the very last people who gets the hard copy New York Times delivered
Oh
to my
my
house every
God.
day. And
Wow.
I grew up reading it. I grew up in Manhattan, and there was a paper on the breakfast table every morning. So it was like one of the highlights of my life to see my name in that thing. And I was refusing to open the link the day before because that's not real to me until I'm holding it in my
Oh.
hand and it's breakfast time. So it was an absolute thrill. And I still don't know exactly the process by which this happens. So if you ever figure it out or someone else knows, it would be nice to know how to shortcut that system. But I'm really grateful that it worked out for me this time.
I love that because I love that it was a surprise to you. I love that it wasn't timed with like the book coming out. It just really felt like what was it, Sarah Lyall?
Yes.
That she just like found your book and was like, this book rocks, you know? Like it just felt really genuine, you know?
Well, you just imagine there's this like portal, whether it's electronic or there's a pile in some office, and these people are going through the books and reading them. And that seems like a inefficient system that you can't crack, but maybe someone opened my PDF or opened my hardcover and liked the book enough to talk about it. So yeah, I'm imagining some kind of archaic system like that.
Did you, was it your decision to put a true crime novel on the cover of the book, or was that a...
Oh man, I could go on for an hour about the 100 emails about that. I'll
Please
go try to
do.
go on for 1 minute. So I wrote a draft of the book, gave it to my agent. He gave it, shopped it around, and there was a subtitle under Kill Show, and it was very, very long. It was something along the lines of an oral history of the dead girl and the reality show that shocked America, something like that. And to me, it was extremely useful in teeing people up to understand what this book was about and some of the, that there was a dead girl at the center of it, some of the genre that we were going to be engaging with. And my publisher was like, this is way too long. And we talked about not having a subtitle. I was like, I don't know. It's confusing. This is pretending to be nonfiction and it's going to be fiction. And they said, their marketing team insisted we need the word novel in the subtitle. And I was like, what? Like, this is, I kind of want people to be confused that it's nonfiction. And then we batted around literally 50 different versions of it. They wanted it super short. So they came up with a true crime novel, which I now love, but is literally an oxymoron. So many people are confused. I'm not sure that's a bad thing, but I've seen enough comments online where people are irritated by it. I was like, okay, there's a few outliers who were irritated, but to me, the word novel is like the definitive word on the cover, which means this is fiction. And you have to do a little extra math in your head. Well, a true crime novel, that must mean it is in that genre, but still, not real. So
So,
is that your impression of
yeah,
what happened when you picked up the cover?
I it's so unique because I had a similar feeling like you did when you were reading Daisy Jones and the Six, where I was kind of like, wait a minute, is this real?
Right.
And then I would keep coming back to the word novel, and I'd be like, no, it's a novel. And then I'd be like, but wait, and I love that. I love that feeling. I think
I
that's
think
very
you I think
useful.
that works for most people, and then there's a vocal minority that is pretty irritated by it and kept Googling it and then Googled it at the end and were like really either disappointed to, and then some people were just shocked, being like, I can't believe I never heard about this. This is so crazy. I was like, I guess that worked on you.
Well, I kind of struggled with like when I was like when Roxanne was reading Hot Springs Drive to decide whether or not she wanted to buy it. And even after that, like when we were talking about, editing and publicity and stuff, and I kind of like thought, oh, I shouldn't, like, am I allowed to tell people that this is based on real people? Like, and so I was worried about that. And I didn't want to like upset any of the actual people involved in the actual crime. So I kind of like didn't really talk about it a lot. And now I'm like, I get a lot of people being like, oh, wait, this is based on a real thing that happened. And it kind of deepens their understanding of it. I think it like makes it even more interesting. And I'm kicking myself now. And I'm like, I should have said this is inspired by true events. I feel
Yeah,
like
okay, so
that's.
I'm sitting here with my jaw on the floor because I did not know. I thought you created that entirely from whole
No.
cloth. And now I see you relating a little bit more to this kind of tone. That's
Yes.
really interesting. And I don't think you necessarily made a mistake. I appreciate being told this, but I actually am really relieved that I got to read your novel without knowing that. Like I think it was more exciting to me to be like, oh my God, the sequence and the characters here are so rich, and I was so kind of in awe of that that I would have been taken out of it a little bit if I knew it some of the events had happened in some way.
That's what, yeah, that was my fear, was like, is it going to make it feel corny in some
Yeah,
way,
and yeah, so I think you made the right choice. And then for both of us, I don't know that there is that perfect phrase something a little more exciting than inspired by true events. Like a true crime novel's imperfect, so there might just be no little thing you can tell the reader that is the perfect amount of kind of excitement and warning and clarification.
Well, Noah Hawley talks about,
Oh,
because he's
yes, I know.
the
He's,
Fargo
yep, go
dude.
ahead.
Love him so much. He talks about like the opening of every episode and the opening of the Coen Brothers film as well, where it's like, this is a true story. And he's like, there's the word true and there's the word story.
Absolutely.
You
I
know?
don't know if that was in my head, but that's doing the exact same thing. That's great.
I mean, I would listen to him talk about writing for the rest of my life if I could.
Well,
But
isn't it just interesting that that is a normal phrase we use all the time, a true
yes,
story?
right.
That just sums up what we're doing, right?
I mean, there's like an element of storytelling in fact and fiction, right? And so
Right.
it's exactly those decisions we've been talking about people making, whether for nefarious reasons or just for clarity reasons or whatever, you know, like there's just the way that we shape these things that we're telling.
And if I can be so insufferable, there's an element of human truth in every fictional story as well.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I would totally agree with that. Although I think some of my students who like don't write, who like to write genre, they'd be like, "Wait a minute."
They're like, we're not saying anything about the human condition.
Exactly, right. No, we're talking about the space alien cyborgs or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel. This has been such a delight. I loved Kill Show. Everyone should read it if you haven't already. It is so good. I can't wait for what you're going to write next.
Neither can I, but yeah, thank you for having me. This was such a fun conversation, and I really feel like I was connecting with a kindred spirit here. So it's nice to
Likewise.
know there's another person out there thinking similar thoughts.
Here I am. It's just me.